Podcast, the podcast all about intro psych. I am joined as always by my friend and colleague, Paul Bloom. Paul, welcome.
Hi, David. Good to talk to you. We have an unusual episode today.
Yeah, it's not normally we've been going through every chapter of your book, Psych, but today we have a surprise.
For those people who are old enough to have watched David Letterman, it's viewer mail.
mailbox, yes. So Paul solicited on Twitter questions for listeners to write into us, and you've compiled a whole bunch of questions. So we're going to try to go through a few of the questions. We can't do all of them, of course.
Apologies for those we missed. Some we missed because they were, the ones we missed were ones we couldn't answer, either because they were unanswerable, or sometimes they were actually excellent questions that neither one of us had much to say about. So it's not as if we're going to give wonderful answers to all the ones we did accept, but at least we have a shot at them.
You know, the way that I approached this particular episode anyway is like getting questions at the end of a class where we're kind of forced to speak from what we know, but we don't have like unlimited time to do the research.
So we begin all of our answers with excellent question. use that a way to stall for time.
That's right. So we're not mentioning the names of the people who wrote us unless they specifically said that it was okay. So the first question is, if the unconscious is so important for cognitive science in general, what is the relevance of the conscious mind? What was the evolutionary advantage of processing information consciously? Couldn't it all be done unconsciously in the same way, say, that a lot of thinking already is, since it tends to be faster and reasonably accurate to be useful in our ecological environment?
That is actually an excellent question. There's a lot of debates over the function of consciousness. And one thing to keep in mind is that consciousness has different meanings. So one sense of consciousness is qualitative experience. And we've talked about this before. It's the experience of stepping on a thumbtack or getting your first kiss or, you know, eating some spicy curry, just feeling. And the question as to why we have that is a matter of tremendous debate. Why aren't we just zombies running around doing things without qualitative feelings? But there's another notion of consciousness in which we sometimes say, well, somebody who's awake is conscious, somebody who's asleep is unconscious. You're conscious of something if you could talk about it, if you could reason about it, if you could think about it. So for instance, right now I'm conscious of looking at you over Zoom, but I'm not conscious of my blood pressure or my heart rate. And the reason why we have that kind of consciousness seems to be that it's useful to have some sort of information available to all parts of the brain. It's useful to be able to take information I have, say something I've seen, think about it, make a decision, tell you about it. You hear what I have to say, you think about it, you store it in your memory, you make plans. And as such, it makes global reasoning possible. It connects reasoning with perception. It connects reasoning with action. So I think that's the simplest story for why we have consciousness. In the sense of consciousness, that means access, what the philosopher Ned Block actually calls access consciousness, distinguished from phenomenological consciousness, which is more mysterious.
Yes, that's a great answer. I was going to say something along the lines of the ability to make plans for the future seems to require that kind of access consciousness. You alluded to this. It doesn't seem like we'd be animals capable of anything like future thought or setting aside our current interests for the sake of our future interests and making plans like that, let alone sharing those plans, talking about why we did things, explaining, justifying our behavior to others. All that seems to require some kind of access to certain thoughts.
That's right. And that raises the question of what creatures have this consciousness and what don't. I think that certainly any animal is capable of planning and some degree of strategy, you know, certainly other primates, for instance, almost certainly have it. But then as you get to, you know, I don't know, mice or cockroaches or worms, it becomes more of an open question. And the perennial question now is what about, you know, ChatGPT? Does right. it have that sort of consciousness? And in some sense, Well, in some sense, I think it does. I think we could argue a lot about phenomenological consciousness, but it is able to take the same bit of information and use it and transfer it from one system to another and analyze it and go back to it and so on. So you could have a conversation with it, and then conversation maybe in quotes, and then it stores some information in memory and can retrieve it.
Well, that, you know, it reminds me of something that you said in one of our previous episodes about the difference between computer memory and human memory. In some way, if we restrict the definition of consciousness to this form of access consciousness, and we say that a computer has it, ChatGPT or whatever computer actually has access to all information in it, right? So yeah. There is no, even if it has subroutines running in the background, it can pull those and let you know exactly what's going on.
Yeah. So in some sense, it's conscious of just about everything that's ever happened on the web, for instance, because that's part of its training material. Okay, this one's for you. It's often said, and we said this on our podcast, that once you reach a certain household income, additional income doesn't move the needle for happiness. However, Sapolsky writes about how we get dopamine when we're basically doing better than our peers. Do you think the research suggests we're only happy when we out-earn our neighbors? Or have I misread the research?
Again, excellent question. And it turns out that this is a matter of some debate. I think that what is true that we can say the research definitely shows is that happiness does increase with absolute income. On average, making more money up to a certain point does seem to improve happiness, independent of whether or not people around you are making more or less. But there is evidence that at some point, the relative income also matters. And so there seem to be two effects here. One is the absolute income and one is the relative income, and they don't necessarily conflict with each other. There's some suggestion that the relative income effect shows up more in developed countries, that is where the average income is higher. So we're going to talk about this in our happiness episode. There's all sorts of things that matter deeply for happiness that can be taken care of with a minimal amount of income. Once you get above that level, though, it doesn't seem to matter so much. And in countries where most people are above that level, maybe how much your peers earn actually ends up mattering a bit more. I'm sure that there is still debate about the size of these effects, like which one outweighs the other, but I'm pretty confident that both effects are there.
Yeah, I am too. And it's not controversial that at the low levels, more money makes you happier in the absolute sense. And it would be bizarre if it didn't. Money buys you, you know, food and shelter and medical care and safety and schooling for your children and so on. And then, again, not surprisingly, there's diminishing returns. If you're making $50,000 a year and you make another $10,000, that's a big difference. If you're making $250,000, you might not even notice another $10,000. But I think, and this is controversial, but I think the studies suggest that even as you go up to making $1 million or more, there's still a mild happiness boost from the extra money. It's mild, but it's there. And I don't think that we should think that this is best thought of as well, somebody who makes $2 million can buy more great stuff than $1 million or are happier. I think rather it's as the questioner points out, it's an aspect of status. You know, if I'm making more money than all the people around me, even if we have the same lifestyle, still I could say to myself, I'm higher on the status hierarchy indexed by money.
And, you know, independent of the effects on happiness, there is research showing that people explicitly say that they would prefer to live a life in which they earned slightly more than the people around them than they would making more money, but equivalent to those around them.
Yes, it's a classic psych question, which is, you know, would you rather make a certain amount of money that's less than the people in your office? Or would you rather make more money than the people in your office, but in an absolute way is less than option one? And, you know, you feel, no matter how you answer that, you feel the pull. On the one hand, more money is better than less money. You know, you can buy goods and services with it. But on the other hand, we compare ourselves. It matters a lot. It's very painful to know that the person next to you and the person on the other side of you, they get the same, and they get paid more than you. And maybe it's somewhat satisfying to know that they get paid less than you.
Good. Okay, next question. Paul, could you comment on the ubiquity of quote-unquote trauma in pop and clinical psychology at the moment? Is this just the latest flavor of blank slateism?
It's interesting. By blank slateism, the questioner is referring to the notion that everything is learned. Steven Pinker wrote a very well-known book called The Blank Slate, where he talks about the ideology that nothing is inborn, nothing's innate. And people who agree with Pinker's take on it, and kind of our take as well, would call that a blank slateist idea. There's a rich and complicated literature of trauma that runs through clinical psychology, and it runs through actually a lot of the humanities, a lot of discussions of literature, discussions, broader philosophical discussions over a meaningful life. And all I have to add to that is that I think we overstate the effects, the traumatic effects of bad events in our lives. So people talk about post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a psychological disorder that follows traumatic events. And this definitely exists. And many people are scarred to varying degrees by terrible events that have happened in their past. But it turns out, and the psychologist George Bonanno has a really good discussion of that in a recent book. It turns out that we are much more resilient than expected. So for instance, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is the exception. It's not the rule. You have cases where you know, people go through immense trauma of various sorts, and most people are resilient. It's not that the events aren't horrible. It's not that they don't cause pain. But it does seem to be that, and as time goes by, people recover and get back to normal. So I don't want to say trauma plays no role in our psychological lives. I'm not a trauma denialist, but I do think that along with the story of the effects of trauma comes, a really important story of resilience.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything you said. And it is important to highlight that, you know, there are people who, for instance, have researched the resilience of survivors of sexual abuse. And they have been accused of minimizing the impact of sexual abuse. And I think it should be very clear that whether or not people are okay after terrible things have happened to them does not mean that those terrible things are in any way okay to do.
And I think people get confused about that. I think people often think, well, to say that something, people recover from something, is to say that something isn't serious, or that something, if it's done by a person, isn't immoral. But it's fully compatible saying, you know, you do terrible things to a person and a person could recover, and yet they're still terrible. Okay, this one's for you. In chapter 7, you mentioned that memory is essentially limitless, but note that the brain is a limited physical object. My concept of memory is more like computer memory with garbage collection. I studied geophysics in college, but after writing software for a decade, I don't remember anything about the Earth. My mind seems to nearly turn over every 5 or so years. We know that memory is flawed and distorted over time. Is our mind compressing the memory, reducing it to fewer story beats? It could then uncompress it later, interpolating the gaps with whatever trope from recent lived experience snugly fits. Simply put, what are the limits of memory for a normal non-savant person who doesn't train for memory competitions?
I like taking the computer metaphor seriously and asking about compression. So I'll attempt an answer that I think is understanding of what is being asked here. We do know that memory is not like computer storage for the reasons that the questioner says. We can't access our memories perfectly like a computer can. So there is some decay of information, whether it's because of interference, that is, more information kind of crowds out the information that you stored, or whether it's because things were never stored in long-term memory to begin with. The things that you remember are never going to be sort of a perfect record of the things that happened to you. Now, compression. I don't know if the metaphor of compression is something that researchers in memory use directly, but the idea here is that you take whatever large amounts of information are being encoded and you reduce those somehow algorithmically in a way that they can be reconstructed perfectly at the time of decompression. That is what compression would do in a computer. It's lossless compression. I don't think that the brain could work that way. I don't think it does work that way. So there's a distinction that some memory researchers make between verbatim and gist memory. Verbatim would be, as it sounds, you remember every bit of information that you're trying to, right? So memory champions have to verbatim repeat the order of every card in a deck of 52 cards. Gist memory is when you just remember the gist of the thing that happened to you. And that, of course, seems like an efficient way to store events for which details don't matter. And I think that over time, what you can retain much more easily is the gist of something that happened to you. Now, when you recollect it and you infuse information from things that were after that event, and memory gets distorted, I don't think that's the same thing as decompressing, because you actually are filling it up with stuff that never was there to begin with. And that's what memory distortion is. So I wouldn't call that decompress it. But I think that it's very true that, as the questioner says, you interpolate the gaps with whatever trope from recent lived experience snugly fits. Maybe trope isn't the right thing to say, but we definitely infuse our memory with details that may not have been there to begin with.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. The examples abound. There's some, I forget who said this, but they were describing having read War and Peace, and then it said, "Well, I remember it was about Russia."
And right.
And you know, so we retain the gist. I mean, a more personal thing, I think a lot of people will have some sympathy with is arguments with your partner or your spouse, where you have an argument some time ago, and you know, for minutes afterwards, of course, you'd remember everything very clearly. But all you remember later is that person was mean to me and wrong. But then you're reliving it, and then all of a sudden you say, "I remember what you said, and then you kind of switch, and they say, "I didn't say that." No, instead you said, and what you're doing now is you're not like you have the perfect memory and you're bringing it all back. Rather, you're infusing it with whatever you feel at the time, you know, the tropes, as the person said, and your own bad feelings.
There is a famous study in memory where you show people a picture of a professor's office, and then you have them recall the details of that picture. And in the original picture, there are no books in the office, but when people report their memory for that picture, they say there were books. And that's because there is a prototypical notion of a professor's office that we have culturally, in which professor's office has books in it. And so we just kind of fill in those gaps. And it's not, as I think, as we say in our memory episode, this is not an unreasonable strategy. Oftentimes that will yield a true memory.
There's a million examples like this, you from psychological experiments. This is a very robust field of psychology. But there was a study that did something like got people to remember a series of words. And the words are, you know, chapter, title, cover, reading, and so on. And then later you ask them what words were part of your list, and you put in the word book. And they always say yes. But book wasn't part of the list. Rather, book is just very associative with all of these things. So you tend to remember this.
Yeah.
You know, I have a question. I'm springing this on you because maybe you have no idea. But I've been, every time I read books about memory or I listen to lectures on memory, it's always you throw away the specifics and you retain the gist. And this seems right almost all the time. But except when I read a passage from a book I've read before, or a podcast or an audiobook I've heard, I often remember exactly where I was when I heard that or when I read that. It just comes back to me, and that seems to violate everything we know about memory.
No, what you're describing is a very real effect. First of all, that task that you described with the chapter book or whatever, that's a famous protocol known as the Diess-Roediger-McDermott task, which is used for this very thing, to show false memories. The effect of geographical location on our memory is a strong one. And I have the same thing that you have, which is when thinking about, say, a podcast episode, I remember exactly where I was when I heard it. And that is just because our brains seem very specialized for spatial memory. So we seem to recruit that ability to remember spatially by association. So it's actually one of the tasks that memory champions use is to harness the geographical, the specialization of our brain for geographical memory and create these memory palaces in their mind with geographical layouts.
That's fascinating. So maybe spatial memory in some way is more specific and more verbatim in a sense than these other forms of memory.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that must be right.
Cool.
But, okay. This comes from a data scientist who asks, I listened to your episode on behaviorism and I couldn't help but think that operant conditioning is analogous to how many machine learning algorithms work, statistical learning. My view is current machine learning algorithms are the behaviorism of artificial intelligence. If their purpose is to produce artificial general intelligence, then these systems will never be sufficient.
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot wrapped up in it, and it's not my field, but I think that the analogy is correct. In fact, one of the methods that's used by in AI, particularly for sort of statistical learning, is known as reinforcement learning, reinforcement models. And, you know, what they do is the models sort of send out a hypothesis and then they get corrected in some way. Either they often is compared to the input, how well they manage to map some part of the input. And it's often explicitly, there's explicit shout out to Skinner for that idea. And, you know, Skinner's own ideas, the idea you throw out a lot of stuff and some of it comes back with a gold star and some of it doesn't, and that shapes you, is itself, and he was very explicit about this, rooted in Darwinian theory. And he made the analogy between his work and Darwin's theory of natural selection in a science article called Something Like Selection by Consequences. So he said that just as the Darwinian story is, you have all of these random mutations and random interaction through sexual intercourse leading to sort of different animals have different collections of genes. Some of them do well, some of them don't. Those that do well themselves reproduce more and so on and so on. Similarly, for behavior, you throw a lot of random behaviors in the world. Some of them get reinforced, some of them don't. Those that get reinforced get built upon. And in natural selection, you develop incredibly complicated organisms. In human action, you develop incredibly complex behaviors. And so in another way to make the analogy would be genetic algorithms, which are explicitly designed to mimic natural selection. Now, you might say, well, we were kind of harsh on Skinner and said this is a terrible theory of human development. There's a lot more going on. And say, well, I mean, AI is doomed if they rest too much on this. But the problem, one of the problems with Skinnerian theory is that the sort of consequences, the data necessary to shape behavior doesn't seem to exist in the human environment. So, for instance, children are not, you know, rewarded and punished for obeying syntactic rules. Maybe when you develop an AI system, you really do set it up so the reinforcement is there, in which case I wouldn't necessarily, you know, insist that it can't work.
Yeah. You know, I recently finished reading this book by Stephen Wolfram on ChatGPT. And I bring it up because there's a relevant discussion at the end where he says that these large language models suffer for the reason that they don't have symbolic knowledge.
Yeah.
Right. And so he proposes that in order to get a really smart AI, you need to combine a set of concepts that provide a true, accurate representation of the world. And you feed that combined with the large language models that are all based on statistical learning. And there you can get, he believes, a really smart engine. And whether or not that's artificial general intelligence or not, I don't know. But it seems that that would be mimicking the way that we learn in a better way.
I think that's right. Gary Marcus has been arguing for many years that models that just work on statistics alone will always fail. The human mind uses symbols implicated in logic and mathematics and other forms of complex reasoning. And unless you equip these machines with the ability to do symbolic reasoning, they're not going to behave in a sophisticated human-like manner. And this shows up in certain ways. So the systems we have, you know, Bing, ChatGPT, are in some way extraordinarily impressive. I'm totally blown away by them. But they also have certain glitches. So Gary points out they have problems with multiplication. You multiply 2 4-digit numbers because that's a very symbolic activity and it's hard to do just based on associations. Also, more generally, I've been playing with this a lot, and they hallucinate and they make up stuff. And it doesn't seem to be an easy problem to fix, because if you're just a statistical machine, there's no real sharp distinction between something which is true versus something which is sort of true or could be true or seeming truthy.
Yeah. And it's not as if we can't get, for many problems, like 95% of the way there. Visual object recognition is one of these, where if you just train up the model, you get really close. But there's always that just little bit missing that human brains seem to do better. The question is whether we can, just through sheer computational power, get anywhere closer, or whether it is a barrier, a natural barrier to these statistical approaches.
It could be argued they have all the shiny stuff, but until they add symbols, you're missing that little part.
Yeah. And to be fair, there are people who disagree with us. This is not like a settled.
Yes, I was going to insist that we're right, but of course, okay, that adds nothing to the conversation. Okay, we got a meta one. This one is actually quite a bit of fun. How do you guys, as non-specialists, go about researching and talking about topics and papers outside of your field? I imagine there's a big risk of a Dunning-Kruger problem, and this is a famous claim that people who know the least about the topic are most confident of their knowledge. A Dunning-Kruger problem, where you wander into, say, a psychopathology journal, read a couple of papers, and think you have the topic down, and go write your chapter on psychopathology, only to have a specialist in that field come up to you later and tell you you are a sophomoric idiot who wrote about their field with no depth or understanding. Do you have specialists review your chapters or lectures? How do you handle this?
First of all, I often am a sophomoric idiot. So. Well, let's take the latter one first. I think it's absolutely the case that you have specialists review what you write. And I know for a fact that you, Paul, had specialists review some of your chapters, right?
Particularly for the psychopathology chapter, actually, because it is a topic. I'm not a clinician. I don't study mental illness. And I had, I had 4 people who is a deeply respected specialist in the field, give me comments.
And I think that's the responsible thing to do whenever you're, even when you're not stepping outside your field. I mean, that's why presumably peer review is important for publication. This is a concern always, at least in my mind, that when I wander into domains that are outside of my area of expertise, which is, you know, 99.9% of the field, that I might get something wrong. I'll say a few things. One is that one of the things that you get trained on, that I believe is one of the most important things to learn when you say go to graduate school, is a set of tools, ways to evaluate research, knowledge about things like statistics and experimental design, and even knowledge about journals, which journals are good and which journals aren't, that I think get us quite a bit of the way there in being able to give good answers about areas that are outside our direct expertise. So if you ask me about visual cognition, even if I weren't able to ask some of my friends who do visual cognition, I think I could look up papers and evaluate the research to a certain extent. Just because a lot of the knowledge that we have about how to do psychology is general, and it allows us to evaluate good from bad. At that point, if I'm not sure, I just straight up have to rely on experts. And if I don't know experts, I'm willing to cold call one.
Yeah. There's a skill we have. We don't boast very much about our training, our skills, but there is a skill that most people in the sciences and the humanities have, which is how to start from scratch. And you see that it's a skill when you see people who don't have that training who are bad at it. And so sometimes you encounter people who are self-taught in an area, and sometimes they're absolutely brilliant. They know a lot about the area. Maybe they have a perspective on the area which is original and creative. But sometimes you see people who are self-taught, and they just started with the wrong thing, and they ended up with some crackpot theory and crackpot analysis that nobody takes seriously, nobody should take seriously. The way I address a new issue is actually just similar to what you're saying. I this morning, I started to work on this article that's going to have some discussion of the alignment problem in artificial intelligence. And I don't know what the alignment problem really is. I know very little about it. So I did two things. One thing is I emailed a friend of mine, actually a student who works in the alignment problem. And I said, I want to learn more about this. What do you recommend? And the second thing is I go to Google Scholar and I look for review articles that are in like recent review articles in respected journals or even sometimes in respected popular sources. You know, I wouldn't turn away from a discussion in a New Yorker, for instance, because it tends to be well-researched and well-fact-checked. And I might end up thinking, I don't buy the establishment view on this topic. I want to go in a different direction. But you start off by finding out what the establishment view is.
I remember when I was a graduate student, early on, I wanted to learn more philosophy, specifically ethics, narrative ethics. And I would go to the library and I would just go to that section and I would look at the books and I would pull out books and I would check them out and I would try to read. And it turns out that this was a terrible way to start learning about the field. It wasn't until I took a course from somebody who knew normative ethics very well, who was able to tell me, no, that's not good. This is good. Start here. Don't start there. You always run the risk of having, you know, maybe missing out on stuff that you should read that maybe the establishment rejected and is actually brilliant. But by and large, expertise matters. And finding an expert will get you a lot of the way there.
And I'll say something which I guess may be obvious, which is this is an easier process if what you're interested in learning is visual perception or short-term memory, sticking within our field. If what you're interested in learning about is what's a very politicized issue, then it gets harder. Because if it's an issue, for instance, where there's sort of a received view on it, and people get in a lot of trouble diverging from received view, you run the risk that even the experts are somewhat biased against the truth. You also run the risk of finding some sort of crackpot, because there'll be far more crackpots in an area such as, I don't know, climate change than an area such as auditory perception, because people have strong feelings and strong investments and strong political commitments.
Okay, this one's for you, Paul. Would people really care about turning off a conscious MacBook Pro? We live in a world where around 98% of people, including psychologists and philosophers, support the confinement, torture, and mutilation of 70 billion sentient farm animals every year. Asking for a radical vegan friend.
This is a short question, but it troubled me and because it made a really good point. I'm promoting my book Psych, and I'm often on podcasts, and we often end up talking about AI, as we've been talking about here, because everybody wants to talk about it, and about the consciousness of AI, and which is a topic I get to in the book, and we've talked about on this podcast. And I end up saying something like, if we ever encountered an intelligence that looked like a person, acted like a person, and displayed emotions and so on, it would be irresistible. We couldn't help but think of it as a conscious, sentient being, deserving of rights, deserving of privileges, and so on. So this question is kind of a response to this, which is when we're dealing with creatures where plainly they are sentient. You know, I don't think, I can't imagine anybody denying that a cow, a pig, or a chicken could feel pain. We're entirely comfortable, most people, 98% say, with their confinement, torture, and mutilation. So on the one hand, you know, you might be saying, well, people just naturally predispose when we hit conscious being to care about them and take their lives as having value. On the other hand, we are monstrously indifferent to the suffering of billions of sentient creatures. And I think the way around them is, I don't see the 70 billion animals suffering. It is kept away from my sight. I have sort of plausible deniability. I think we're very good at averting our eyes to things that would trouble us. And I think often our compassion and our empathy and our moral concern are triggered by face-to-face exposure with a suffering creature. I will confess, I eat meat, but yeah. I certainly wouldn't torture a pig, you know, in front of me. The idea would be monstrous. And if you want to say that that's a plausible psychological story, I think it is, but a terrible moral story, we should do better. I'd probably agree.
I have a view that you might disagree with, and that is that what matters for whether or not we treat sentient creatures as deserving of moral protection is their ability to communicate to us, especially via language, that they would rather not be suffering and being tortured and mutilated. Then I'll ask you this here. Do you think that within, say, the next 20, 30, 40 years, there will be substantially more vegetarians or vegans because of this notion that we know that animals are suffering?
I think there will be more vegetarians and vegans, but not for that reason. I think it's pretty clear for everybody that animals are suffering. And you take it as a moral test of humanity. Most of humanity doesn't care. Most of humanity is willing to go with it because we like the taste of meat. I think what's going to cause the change is the introduction of meat substitutes, particularly lab-grown meat. And so people like me who eat meat will say, well, I'd want to be a good person, so I'll move to the substitutes. And that could cause a revolution. But, you know, since the publication of books like Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, which called people's attention to the suffering of animals, made a strong moral case, I don't think there's been the rise in vegetarians and vegans that anybody's expected.
Yeah, certainly not what I think you might expect if you believed that humans had moral compassion for the suffering of other creatures. You know, I'm a vegetarian. I was raised a vegetarian, so I never had to undo my meat eating, and I don't know whether I would be able to. But it is striking to me that people have seen the suffering of animals many, many times. And this doesn't make a dent. So I think to answer directly the question, I would turn off a conscious MacBook Pro. I probably wouldn't care. I don't think I would care. I also like, by the way, that it's a MacBook. If he or she had asked, is it a Dell? Then maybe I would have answered.
I'm a committed Mac user, and I think sentience is going to come first to the Macs. then the PC is going to try to fake it, but it's not, only the Macs will be conscious. That's an amusing end to a grim topic. So this is one by somebody who was corresponding with me, and he agreed to have his name Kyle Miller Hesed. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And it was such an interesting correspondence based on the podcast. What he said was, is this, I wanted to argue for a greater role of language in limiting and encouraging thought. And I think either of you were willing to concede. And in fact, he's talking about the episode on language where we were quite skeptical of the claim that language shapes thought. And in particular, that the language you learn, English or French or Korean or Hindi or whatever, leads people to think in different ways. So he says, here are some examples off the top of my head. Words as labels. Without these flags, it's harder to notice things, as in like identifying emotions. Personal experience. I often don't know what I really think until I start putting ideas into words, and then I may need to revise or redefine those thoughts. Then there's words as scaffolding for thought. So Sam Harris makes the argument that ideas matter a lot, and words that name these ideas, are important for precise philosophical, legal analysis. And later on, he notes that we had a great example in an unrelated episode where we acknowledge that how a person categorizes something has a dramatic impact on how they experience it. So ends by saying, I think that language is so fundamental for how we process the world. It's hard to imagine how limited we would be without it, or even how differently we might process the world for different language, or even terminology or a framework. So I think that's a really cool set of issues, a nice challenge to what we were talking about.
Yeah. Maybe it's a matter of emphasis, but I do think that we granted that all of these things matter. So what you attend to, how you categorize, what you remember, all of those things really are shaped by the language that you speak. Those are real effects. They're true. You are more likely to remember colors that you have words for. But I think that what we're arguing against is a fairly extreme claim that our thinking is constrained by language in a way that I don't think makes any sense, for the simple reason that all of these words have had to be created and invented by human beings by being thought about first. And I don't think there's any way to get around that. The stuff that language is made of is stuff that has been thought about before that language ever came about. So what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. I'll push back on one thing. So here's a sense which all three of us, I think, agree, our questioner and you and me. One thing is language could convey thoughts. This is what we're doing now. Most, 99.9% of what I know is because somebody told it to me or I read it. And so language does that. The second thing is, I would agree. There's a line by Dan Dennett, the philosopher Dan Dennett, which is, the kind of mind you have with language is so different from the kind of mind you have without language that it's not clear a second one could be called a mind at all. I think that's a bit too strong, but I don't doubt that the possession of a language, a human language, lets me do things with thoughts I wouldn't otherwise do. I could plan a 10-step process just while walking down the street in my head. I want to do this, then I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do this. And I don't think I'd be able to do that if I didn't have a natural language. I don't think a chimp can do that. Now, then there's what you talked about, which is the differences in the different languages and how they name things in how we think. And everything you said is technically correct. The words languages use affect memory, and they affect reaction time, and they have notable psychological effects. But I would just emphasize the effects are tiny. They're really subtle. So yes, languages have different color words, and this affects our memory and affects our use. But they're you know, percentage point differences. They're fractions of a second. Then there's the big thing, and I'll raise this, and we'll come back and forth on it. Which is, you're right. So suppose somebody was to say, look, the fact that we had that, say, Freudians had a term hysteria, and it was a common then, shaped how we think about certain behaviors and certain thoughts, and without the words we wouldn't think that way. And maybe a modern example would be the phrase long COVID, which is a new phrase, and it's shaped how people think. And your point is, well, that can't be entirely right, because somebody must have, certainly the right story is somebody thought about the idea of hysteria and coined a word for it. Somebody observed symptoms that they decided to think of as long COVID, and they coined this phrase for it. But there may be some room to argue that now that we have the word as a tag, it does make it easier to think about it. It makes it easier to communicate it about it. And maybe it reifies it in that for some things, you know, say hysteria, you might doubt that such a thing exists. But if there's a word for it, it ups the odds that somebody will think that it exists.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, again, that what we were fighting against was the most extreme of the linguistic relativism claims. And we even gave examples of words that, I think I gave the example of the word in Spanish that I use for wearing something for the first time, which is just an idea that wouldn't pop into my head had I not had that word. It would, not very frequently, at least. And I also do think maybe we underplayed that Dennett point that you made, that language does change minds in what has to be a really fundamental way. That is the difference, though, between some language and no language.
That's right. I think there's a profound difference between some language and no language. I'm not sure there's such a difference between English versus Korean. And as a practical manner, it's often hard to tell, because on average, an English speaker will have a different mental life than a Korean speaker regarding foods and cultural practices and holidays and that sort of thing. And certainly that's conveyed by the language, but it just has to do with the fact that, you know, Korean people speak Korean and people in English-speaking countries speak English. It almost certainly doesn't have to do with the structure of the language.
That's a great question and good pushback.
Okay, I got one for you, though. I'm going to then let you say the name of the of the questioner. As you know, psychology often employs statistical measures such as averages and correlations to capture various phenomena. My question is, how much of a phenomena could be explained by a given theory and how much variation remains unexplained? For instance, a method that yields the best results on average may not be the best fit for an individual. So is it better to rely on the science of psychology or to use common sense and personal intuitions?
Warm regards from Prague. I'm going to attempt the name Jiří Vančura. You can tell me if I said that right or wrong. Great question. It is absolutely true that so much of our science really is a science of averages. Our statistics, our experimental designs that are interpreted through the use of statistics are often using some measure of central tendency, the average. And we tell the difference between two groups, an experimental group and a control group. We look at averages. And when you look at distributions, you can eyeball it and obviously see that, for instance, this manipulation didn't work for everybody. There are always going to be outliers, and those distributions are always going to be overlapping. There is, I guess, a collection of subfields within psychology that focus on individual differences. You might ask the difference, for instance, about trauma that we were discussing earlier. What makes it so that some people who experience the exact same event as somebody else, what makes it so that one of those people is absolutely shattered and the other person doesn't seem fazed at all? That's a question about individual differences. And if what you're looking to do is predict those kinds of differences, then I do think it's dangerous to look at averages. I don't think that the conclusion is that it's better to rely on common sense and personal observation. I guess I would push back on that and say that no, what you want to rely on is a different way of looking at the question scientifically. What do you think?
Yeah, to some extent, psychology can traffic in absolute principles. Maybe at the neural level, if this happens and this happens, boom, boom, a causal process that we have understood. Maybe even at the sort of more cognitive and abstract level, you might say, well, if you remember a series of words, this word will be forgotten more easily than that word and so on. But when it comes all the way up to the sort of the grand scheme of everyday life, so many processes interact and there's so much having to do with history and environment that just absolute generalizations will never happen. We always have averages. We always deal with, like you say, distributions and statistics. So I said before, most people who have traumatic events are resilient, but that's a generalization. Some people aren't. For most people, apparently, the best time to work is the morning, but there's some people who work in the evening. This way of studying will help most people, but not others. So what do you do if you're trying to get sort of practical advice over how to study or what treatment to take if you're depressed or, you know, something like that? And I would think sometimes you'd want to have a scientific eye. You don't want to, you know, you don't want to look at tea leaves or ask a spiritual figure or listen to your dreams. But careful observation, I wouldn't call it anecdote, but careful observation of yourself may be a better guide than going to a psychology textbook. Say, if I want to know how many hours of sleep I need to function best, what a psychology textbook could tell me on average how many people tend to need, but there's of course great variance. So if I want to know for myself, I could probably do well just by trying out different amounts of time and seeing how well I fare.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, in fact, I use a sleep tracker so I can kind of tell when I get certain amount of sleep, what my, say, heart rate the next day is, or even if I have elevated temperature. So I guess I would just say the closer you can get to being rigorous in your observation, the better off you're going to do.
That's right. That's right.
You made a point about there being so many things at play for any given effect that there's tons of interactions, like personality, genetics, that are all at work in any decision that you make or thought that you have, that it does sometimes seem a bit futile to use any findings for specific advice. I think that psychologists, we are often a bit too quick to present this information as stuff that would work as advice to an individual.
I think that's absolutely true. It's a sin that people, particularly in, say, positive psychology, are guilty of. And I've heard some of the best positive psychologists rebel against this, say, you shouldn't tell people, this is what to do to be happy. This is what to do to be productive. This is what to do to be successful. Because you could say, on aggregate, this tends to work for most people. But rather, I think the best suggestion is try out different things. Try out different things and see what works for you. I like the idea of your sleep tracker, and then it comes under life hacking, which is, there's psychology as a field, which we're talking about, but we can be psychologists about our own mental life, in a sense that we take a scientific approach to it. And it could involve what kind of health things like sleep and diet and exercise and what works best for us. But it also involve how we deal with people, our own psychologies. We could study our minds in kind of a serious sense and ask ourselves, what makes me happy? And I think one of the lessons of happiness research, which works for the most part, is that we're very bad at our gut feelings of predicting what makes us happy. We often have the wrong theories of what makes us happy. So the solution to this is collect data. Collect data. Ask yourself at the end of a day, say, what part of that day did I enjoy? What part of that day did I not like? And it might be after you look at 2 weeks of your data, you say, oh my gosh, I thought I liked this, but I didn't. And to my surprise, I seem to be really much happier in the afternoon, stuff like that. Not the kind of things you'd find in a psychology textbook, but useful for everyday life.
By the way, there are mood tracker apps that you can download that you just input how you're feeling every day and maybe get some insight. But I'll add this last thing, which as you were talking, I thought about this. Sometimes other people are better at telling you what works and what doesn't in your life.
Yes.
So anybody who's had children knows this, but when your child doesn't get enough sleep and they get cranky, you can tell them you didn't sleep. That's why you're cranky. And they'll, of course, resist this because they think, there is some objective reason. The food you gave me was actually terrible. but we know because we can observe in a bit more of an impartial way.
When you said everybody who has children, I was thinking of the opposite direction, which is my children have told me, Dad, you're a real jerk when you get tired.
Right. That's also true. Yeah. They have to. Yeah.
You have to be prepared for the fact. And this comes into a sort of a deep point about the lack of accessibility we have to all sorts of aspects of ourselves. Yeah. A very Freudian point. We have to be open to the possibility that other people might know us better than we do.
Okay, this next one comes from Tyler. This is probably veering into the realm of philosophy, but I know you two are open to that. My question, what do you make of the extended mind theory? Is it useful to think of my phone or my notebook as actually being a part of my mind? Does this have implications for the study of psychology?
It's a really interesting issue. I've heard Andy Clark, the philosopher Andy Clark, talk about this, and I don't have a settled view. I think what is very clear is that something like a notebook, and particularly something like Google, or maybe, again, to stick to a theme, AIs, will become more integrated into our lives. So that it's the argument that extended mind people make is that it may not be right to draw a hard and fast distinction between a sort of memory you have between your ears and the data that could come to you through your laptop or your notebook if you always have them present. I never know, I'm just going to punt on this, I never know whether to think of that as sort of like a metaphor. Like, wow, it's like the web is kind of like as if it was like a memory. Or whether it's meant to be, or whether it's true as a real substantive claim. I think there's something to the fact that your brain is always with you. That and your notebook and the computer are contingent technological things that you can or cannot use. And I think that difference really does make a difference. I don't know. What's your take?
Yeah, similar pull of intuitions there. I mean, it's something like the issue of personal identity, where it doesn't seem to me that there's a great reason to think that only the things that are within my skin count as me. I think you could make a good argument that what is me is extended. And here's one way, I'll take a stab at one way in which you might seriously view, say, technology as part of your extended mind. I have an iPhone, and on my phone, I get photo memories. It basically just shows me, for instance, on this day 5 years ago, here's what you were doing. Now, we know that the way that memory works is that the more that you rehearse memories, the more likely you are to remember them. So something might escape your memory given enough time if you never boost it with a conversation with somebody else who happened to be there at the moment, or in this case, a picture reminding me of it. I think my mind is substantively changed because of technology like this. I have memories that I probably would not have had otherwise. And there, I would take seriously the claim that my mind may not be just what is within the limits of my skull. But I can't help but think, well, what's the difference between saying that and saying my mind has been helped out by these technologies?
Yeah, I'm even more hardcore than you. I don't have time for this hippie metaphysics. Where you know, right. I like my personal identity is this guy standing right here, not the clothes he's wearing or the chair he's sitting at, and not the laptop that's in front of him. And so now. I don't want to be dismissive. People like Andy Clark, I think David Chalmers have thought yes. deeply about this and made a case that it's more than a metaphor. And Chalmers, who's written a lot about virtual reality and similar topics, might say, look, whatever you think about your notebook or your laptop, soon we will be more integrated into the technological world. So if all of a sudden there's a chip in my head that lets me access the web, then it gets a lot more plausible to think of the web as part of my memory and part of me.
Yeah, what a hardcore physicalist you are.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, I think this is the last one. Sam Rosenblatt sent us a series of excellent questions, and we're just going to deal with the first. And I think what we're going to do is we're just going to bounce back and forth on this until we get tired. But the question is, who are some of the greatest, however defined, living psychologists today?
Well, this is a question that I dread answering, because calling anybody living great is just wounds my pride.
And think of all the people you're going to insult by not talking.
And all the people that I leave off the list, I'm going to insult. I'll start with Paul Bloom. How about that? That's number one great living psychologist.
That just goes without saying.
Yes. So I'll just mention some favorites. Elizabeth Loftus, I think, has to be up there for me. Memory researcher, somebody who has made a real contribution, not just to our understanding of the psychology of memory, but also to the way that law deals with things like eyewitness testimony and police questioning, all those sorts of things. So she's my first vote. What about you?
I will go as a first vote with Susan Carey. And this is a vote which I'm very personally biased. She was my advisor. Last week, I was in Boston for her retirement party. From Harvard, but I think it's actually, particularly if in the field of developmental psychology, it's an easy answer. She has an incredibly substantive work looking at some of the deepest questions there are, including the question of what's the difference between how children think and how adults think. I just, you know, she's done work integrating psychology and philosophy. She's done work connecting across the visual sciences and cognitive science, won every award there is to win, and just this incredibly important figure.
My next one, I think we probably would both have on our list, Paul Rozin.
Oh, Paul Rosin is great. What a good choice.
Yeah. One of the just most interesting minds that I've ever encountered. I think his body of work, it's rare to say of somebody, no matter how good they are, that without their contribution, the field would be radically different. It's a high bar, but I think Paul Rosin, in social psychology at least, the field would be different without his creative thought. So he's most known for his work on disgust. But if you just Google scholar him, you'll see how his reach has extended. And he just has this talent of finding things that nobody else is talking about that probably we should be talking about.
Yeah, I'm a huge Paul Rosin fan. He's had this tremendous personal influence on me and shaping my work. He is, if you define, you know, the best as the most interesting, he is both as a scholar and as a person. He's just a terrific fan. I will take a more establishment social psychologist as my next choice, Dan Gilbert. Dan is this, you know, very creative scholar who's had a tremendous influence on social psychology and also on positive psychology. When we talked before about how we're bad at predicting our future happiness, Dan's done the pivotal work here. There's so many good things you could say about Dan, but one thing I'll say is just he comes out with like two or three experiments, published empirical papers a year. And as the kids say, they're all bangers. They're all just like, they're all these really cool discoveries. I always have a feeling that, that man, I wish I had thought of that. And right. And he's also one of the best, maybe the best writers in our field.
Yes. Well, I'll stick to social psychology too. I will nominate my colleague here, Tom Gilovich, one of my, I think, just heroes. Personally, he's a person that you never hear anyone speak an ill word of him. His character in general is amazing. But he also has this eye for interestingness that I really envy. He's done a lot of great work on human bias in judgment and decision-making. He has done very influential work on regret. He wrote a book on why we make mistakes in the financial domain. He does some of the coolest work looking at sports, right? Like, does the color of uniforms matter? He just has an eye for field experiments, for sources of data that we might not think about. Just, again, a creative mind, good methodologist, very clear writer and thinker.
I agree. I talk about his work on the spotlight effect in my book. And one of my favorite sets of studies from social psychology, that these clever studies showing that we overestimate the extent to which people focus on us. It's as if there's always a spotlight focused on us. And in fact, people are actually not thinking about us. People are thinking about themselves because they have their own spotlight. And it's just imaginative and clever work. I'll dart back to a related field of developmental psychology and put down Elizabeth Spelke, who is, I think, our foremost, and there's a couple of contenders here, but I think she's one of the major researchers on babies. And, you know, sometimes psychology is like long on theories, but short on real discoveries. But she has had real discoveries about what babies know. She's told us babies understand objects, the physical world, the social world, and also just this person of considerable brilliance.
I learned what a Spelke object was before I knew who Liz Spelke was.
Yes. Yes, yeah. A bounded, continuous object that moves through space and time or something.
But yeah. Much like your brain, Paul.
that is me.
You are a Spelke object. I realize I'm doing all social psychologists, although there is a heavy cognitive influence on my picks, for the record. Mahzrin Banaji, your former colleague, our friend. She has done great work on implicit attitudes. Her mind and her influence on the field, I just deeply respect. She is one of my favorite people to talk to. I always come away from my conversations with her feeling like I'm a bit smarter than I was before because of what she said.
Yeah, I am a huge fan of her. And she is a rich and generous thinker.
Yeah. Intellectually honest, I think. Yeah, which you have to be in that field.
I think a lot of people are somewhat skeptical of that area. And they go in and listen to a talk of hers and they think, oh, this is just going to be some sort of, you know, nonsense. And then, Jesus, tremendously persuasive. I'd just like to kind of put her in front of every TV screen in America.
The ability to give a great talk is, you know, a category of its own. And honestly, I put Mazreen up there and you, Paul, as two of the best speakers in the field.
On our list, most of them are great speakers. Not all of them. I'm not going to go through, but some of them are terrible speakers. Yes. And it's funny. Some of these people we're talking about are very active. They may be listening to this podcast. They're on Twitter. They're on email. Others, like my advisor, Susan, I could say with some confidence she is not going to be listening to this podcast. And again, she's not on social media. And somehow, despite this, she's been incredibly productive and led this rich scholarly life. That's so strange. I'll throw, maybe this is a final name, Steven Pinker. Oh. So Steve is a friend. Steve was my secondary advisor when I was in graduate school. And I think he's this extraordinarily imaginative thinker. And people know him for his, more and more for his sort of political and social side, and for his big theoretical contributions. But he's done some, you know, particularly regarding the decline of violence over history, his defense of rationality, and his defense of Enlightenment values. But he's also done some incredibly important empirical work, both in visual cognition and most of all in language, in the nature of language, defending a theory of language acquisition, exploring the use of language, exploring how language works. So I think one of these rare scholars who's both a valuable sort of bench scientist, but also a great theoretician.
And I'd put him right up there with Gilbert as one of the best writers in the field.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to tell an anecdote because I don't know. And I don't know if I'm going to keep it, but it's a memory I have of you very early on. So, Paul, you used to attend our social brown bags, and there was a speaker who I won't name who came and gave a talk. And it is one of the worst talks I've ever seen in my life. Inside psychology, outside of psychology, it was terrible. It was disorganized. It was still using overheads with just paragraphs of text. It was long. And I believe you walked out early. And
this is not a story that reflects well on me.
And so I was talking to you afterwards. I said, yeah, it's naive. You know, this was a famous person. I said, oh, I guess when you're famous, you can give bad talks. And you looked at me and you said, they must be really famous. And then I believe you followed up by saying, I've had more fun at the dentist's office.
Well, so in our next episode, we'll list the worst living psychologists.
So this was a different kind of episode, but I hope it was enjoyable. I hope we dropped some gems. I hope it was a banger, as Paul says.
I've picked this up from the kids, and I want to use it any chance I get. Thank you.